Is it really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Monday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio for this edition of the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hope you had a great weekend. Thanks very much for tuning in as we are in the last full week now ahead of the Christmas holidays. We'll talk to Elise Glink maybe about, well, projections for the housing market, real estate next year, but maybe a little last-minute shopping as well later in the program. We start things off on Monday, usually with the folks from Chicago Inno. Catherine Davis is in the studio this afternoon. Catherine, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
You had a nice weekend, I hope?
I did.
So next week you're off because it's Christmas. So
exactly.
We'll see you in a couple weeks.
That's right.
Thanks for coming by.
Of course.
Wait, that's not it. So we got here this morning is about the time I pulled in, we were getting alerts from Google in New York that they were going to invest $1 billion into an expansion there. And now every time I hear of a big tech expansion somewhere else in the U.S., I think, wait, did Chicago lose out on that? Was that the case or not so much?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, Google already has a pretty big presence here. And back over the summer or early fall, they announced that they are expanding that as well. So they bought another building in Fulton Market. They already employ about 1,000 people here, but they want to, of course, grow that. But this new New York office, they're calling it Google Hudson Square. They hope to move in there by 2022 and double their headcount there to about 14,000 people in the next 10 years.
Is New York becoming, New York's a factor in everything, right? But with the Amazon headquarters going there into the Long Island Yards neighborhood, I think it was.
Right.
Are they becoming a new tech-centric sort of force?
I think so. I mean, you know, New York is kind of the financial capital of the United States, right? There's a ton of talent there. I mean, you know, the East Coast just has, like, you know, huge populations of, you know, really highly skilled, highly educated people. So there's no shortage of talent there for these tech companies that want to hire. And I was reading something this morning, you know, that's saying, you know, a lot of these companies, you know, Google, Facebook, Apple, they start in San Francisco, but San Francisco is becoming so unlivable now. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the average home there is like over $1 million.
Wow.
And so, you know, they're kind of forced to expand and open new offices in places that people are living, that people want to be.
So they have like a legacy headquarters or a legacy presence in the San Francisco area, but they recruit the young workers and do the real work elsewhere?
I think so.
And so is Chicago's expanding then when it comes to Google? So is this a case of where there's plenty to go around? We should be happy for New York?
I think so. You know, Chicago kind of always has a chip on its shoulder when it comes to these kinds of things. You know,
it's kind of hard to be happy for New York, but I'll
right.
try. I'll give it my best shot.
Exactly. Everyone's like, well, everything's already in New York. Like, we could really use something like this here in the Midwest in Chicago. But, you know, I think that'll come in due time. I mean, Salesforce just announced a new tower here, and you know, I think the city is kind of growing at the pace it can right now.
Okay. I love this company, this story about it's Quavos, right? That's how you pronounce it?
Yes.
And we talked about them just a few weeks ago, I think, because they were in the latest tech star round.
Yep.
Now, Quavos, you wrote a story about them. They make healthy snack chips out of egg whites.
Exactly.
I'm hungry.
Yum, right? So they claim that they can pack the nutrition of an omelet into a bag of chips, you know, and they're marketing this towards people who, you know, want to be really healthy and need a high-protein, low-carb diet. So each bag contains 15 grams of protein, 9 grams of fiber, 3 grams of net carbs, and 180 calories total.
So it really is a thing. I mean, this really is a nutritional food.
Exactly.
Because I think a lot of times when you come up with chip alternatives, what you're trying to do is stay healthy and not do damage.
Right.
And in these, they claim you're actually taking a step forward.
Exactly. They kind of came up with this concept because one of the co-founders, Zach, he's actually a type 1 diabetic, and he was constantly looking for snacks that were, you know, low carb and high in protein, because that's kind of what you need with that condition. But, you know, people seem to be interested in Quavos.
Okay, so this comes out of the University of Chicago, right?
That's
two
right.
students there. You come out with a degree at the University of Chicago, a successful startup, man, you're on your way. But they dropped out?
Exactly. They both dropped out after their sophomore year. And it sounds
what
like...
What is their mother thinking right now?
Hopefully. She's probably praying that this takes off.
Right.
But... yeah, you know, I mean, they garnered a lot of attention over the summer from Kraft Heinz. So they launched a new accelerator program here in the city where they give $50,000 to businesses. And Quavos was one of five that was accepted into it.
Okay, so they've got great promise, but still, it's an uphill fight, and I think they one of them told you in the article that they plan to be out of college for many years, right? They think they're not going to go back for a while.
Exactly. They were telling me, you know, we don't think the workload is going to get any lighter with Quavos. You know, things just keep kind of
Have you tried them?
Going. No, I have not tried them.
No.
But I want to.
And they're like the pop chips that... But see, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Pop chips came along, and then I don't know if they're still around, but they're not really a rage.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, we're rooting for the boys.
Yes, we are.
And then we're taking out a loan to buy a bag of chips because they're really expensive.
Yeah. So a bag retails for $3.99.
Is that a two-pound bag?
No, that's 1.4 ounces.
So 1.5 ounces is going to cost you $4.
Exactly.
That's a lot of money,
Catherine. So that's an expensive chip bag. You know, if you see that on the shelf next to a bag of Lay's for $1.99,
right.
Which are you going to choose, right? But, you know, they think that this is going to cater to people who are used to buying expensive products. You know, these people are probably shopping at Whole Foods and constantly looking for healthy alternatives to things and don't mind paying for that at that price point.
All right, it's called Quavos, and right now it's only available in like 10 stores.
Yeah, so they're available in select Freshies around the city, the U Chicago campus stores, and then some other like local groceries.
And they are betting their college education on it, so give them a leg up, go try that. Okay, we also have talked, you guys educated me on co-living and how co-living is greatly growing in Chicago. I think that came from the West Coast, too, predominantly, did it not?
Exactly. It originated in San Francisco.
And so now, because it was so expensive.
Right.
All right. So now there's a new company coming in, and it's called Bungalow, which is kind of funny to me that maybe there are bungalows in San Francisco. I don't know. But a bungalow is sort of, you know, the prototypical Chicago-style house.
Mm-hmm.
And this, what's that show on CBS where they all live in a house and they hate each other? Real World. No, not Real World. There's another one. The Big House, anyway. So they all share a house,
okay.
Right? So there's a bungalow. It's not like an apartment building, but it's a co-living space. Explain this for me.
Yeah. So Bungalow, you know, based in San Francisco, and they're kind of like other co-living companies where they let tenants sign short-term leases to live in like a semi-furnished, you know, place.
So the idea is you've got a house-ish place, but you're only paying what would be equivalent to a studio's rent, or even less than that.
Right. So Bungalow advertises that you can rent their spaces for less than the average, you know, studio apartment in the area. They say 30 to 40% less. But the interesting thing about Bungalow is that, you know, unlike other co-living companies that buy properties and rent them out, Bungalow actually works with homeowners, you know? So if you have a home in the city that, you know, you want to rent out, you can work with Bungalow and they'll help you keep constant, you know, tenancy there.
So I was thinking of the show Big Brother.
So then I start
wondering about what's the city going to say about this? What's the neighborhood going to say if you turn a single family home into sort of a rental unit with multiple dwellings?
Right. I mean, you know, this might be a situation similar to how Airbnb ran into here. Where the city kind of started taxing them and, you know, cracking down on who can actually rent. So that's kind of unclear right now. You know, only time will tell. They just launched last week with homes available in Bucktown and Wicker Park.
But bigger picture, co-living, that's going to be the way young people live in the future, right?
You know, potentially, you know, I think it really comes in handy if you're new to a city, right? So if you just moved to Chicago and you don't know anyone here and you can't afford an apartment on your own, finding roommates is really hard if you don't know anyone there, right? And I think that, you know, co-living companies like Bungalow kind of offer a solution to that.
I don't know if you said earlier too, but you're not tied to like a year lease. You can sign as short as a 4-month lease.
Exactly.
Catherine Davis is a writer for Chicago Inno. You can read more at chicagoinno.com. We will talk to the doctors at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in the second half hour. They set a record this year. The year's not over, and they've set a record for the number of heart transplants in an Illinois hospital. We'll talk to the doctors about why there are more and more transplants being done. There's an interesting fact behind why there are more hearts available. We'll talk about that in the next half hour. That will surprise you, at least Glenn coming along as well. But right now in the studio, Catherine Davis here from Chicago Inno. You hear Catherine and Jim Dahlke on the Inno Minute every day on the opening bell with Steve Grzanich. And, of course, you should subscribe to their daily newsletter, which is called?
The Beat.
The Beat. Go to chicagoinno.com and check that out. Okay, Catherine, we've talked, as long as I've had the show, I think, about this company called Opternative, because they are a true disruptor. The idea was you could take an eye exam on your smartphone, right, or on your computer. You didn't need to go to an optometrist. Just sit down in your office, take it. Well, that was threatening to a lot of optometrists in the eyeglass industry.
Exactly.
And so Opturnative now has changed its name to
Visibly.
And when I first read this, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense to me. I don't quite get it. They've lost their, you know, Opturnative explains what they are. You don't have to go to the optometrist. But the fact is that the Opturnative also needs the eyeglass industry.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, Opturnative has been around now since 2012. And like you said, they make it, you know, this at-home digital vision test. And so they, of course, have to work with optometrists, right? Because once the vision test results are in, the optometrist still has to give the prescription, right?
Visibly. You can't get the glasses without an optometrist prescription.
Exactly. It's not like Opturnative is actually giving the subscriptions. And then the second part of that is that they work with eyewear retailers, so people that sell glasses. You know, they give them their vision test so that they can, you know, sell glasses more seamlessly. Here, take the test, then you get your prescription. Buying glasses is quicker, right? So they changed their name to Visibly, you know, kind of because Opturnative suggests an alternative to the optometrist,
We're not part of those guys.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, I think this is just their way of, you know, as they continue to grow, they want to really make it clear, you know, that they have this business-to-business element and that they are a friend to optometrists and, you know, glasses retailers and not the enemy.
This was done more not for you and me taking a test at home, right? But for the eyeglass industry, they're sort of cozying up to them a little bit more.
Exactly, yeah, because I mean their business depends on them.
All right, not too long ago, too, talking about Techstars, you introduced me. I think you wrote the story, the first one about Tra-La.
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 What?
Voila.
Voila. Tra-La.
Yeah.
It's Tra-La.
Tra-La.
Okay. Are you sure on that? Because I like Tra-La.
I'm pretty sure. I think it'd have an accent over it if it was Tra-La.
It's Tra-La-La-La-La is what I was going for. It's an app where you can teach yourself to play the violin.
Exactly.
And they said that you could learn a song in as few as 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. And so they just made some headlines last week because they raised $1.29 million in a seed round. You know, so this is kind of the boost that they need to, you know, give everyone else kind of the impression that, like, this is... that this works, that this is like a business worth paying attention to. The app has been downloaded more than 60,000 times since they launched.
That's pretty amazing.
It sounds like people are really using this.
Right. And so they said they have given 40,000 first lessons to people.
Exactly.
Which is pretty shocking because I don't know if the first lesson you have to pay for because it costs, what, $120 a year?
Yeah, so $120 per year for unlimited violin lessons. I imagine they have some kind of trial program like most people you know?
Sure.
But, you know, it's pretty inexpensive if you compare it to a violin teacher, right? I mean, because an average, like, one-hour violin class is, like, $50 or more,
and
right?
And you don't have to go to the violin teacher, or the teacher doesn't, you don't have to make time for them to come to you. It's an app you can sit down whenever you want.
Exactly.
And there's science behind it, right? They think it's doing well.
Yeah. You know, the founder actually grew up playing the violin, and, you know, he's like, you know, based on my experience and the research that we've done, like, this works, and people can actually learn how to play the violin through this.
So look for it on your smartphone. You can look up either under Tra-La or Tra-La. Either one will work.
Tra-La.
Have a Merry Christmas, Catherine.
Thanks, you too, Steve.
Thanks very much, Eric Rung. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. A little bit later in this half hour, we'll talk to Elise Glink about with the last big recession, right, it was all about housing, so people were afraid of the housing market. There is a school of thought that thinks housing might be the shelter for the upcoming recession. So we'll talk to Elise about that. But before that, we're going to head to Northwestern Memorial Hospital for some great news. Dr. Alan Anderson is on a phone line. He is the medical director at the Center for Heart Failure at Northwestern's Bloom Cardiovascular Institute. Dr. Anderson, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Good afternoon.
All right, as I said, I'm assuming you see this as a good news story. Northwestern broke the record this year for the number of heart transplants for an Illinois hospital. Tell me about that.
So it's true. The previous record had been set way back in 1995, and so it's been a long time coming, but I think, obviously, we're pleased with our program at Northwestern, but as a transplant physician, I'm also pleased to see that, generally speaking, heart transplants are up throughout the United States, and they're up in Illinois as well.
160, so I think 167 this year in Illinois compared to 139?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So more people are getting the help they need.
You know, Doctor, I was reading the Tribune's got a story up on it, and I was looking at some of your notes, and it didn't surprise me that there's a record being set this year because, you know, progress continues to be made, and I'm sure the procedure is being more and more developed. But it did surprise me that it broke a record that was almost 25 or 23 years old.
Right.
And I'm not sure what my question there is, because why was it that there... I don't know if the question is, why were there so many back then, or why haven't we continued to have more and more as we've progressed?
Right. Well, I think if you look back, generally speaking, most of the programs in Illinois have been doing volumes in the 20 to 30 transplant range, which is sort of average transplant volume, quite honestly, average to slightly above average. Most heart transplant programs only do about do less than 20 transplants a year. But I think over the last several years at Northwestern, our volumes have increased. We see it as our mission to go out into the community, into our hospitals, and identify patients who have advanced heart failure and who can benefit from all the therapies that modern cardiovascular medicine has to offer, not just transplantation.
Maybe I was confusing Illinois numbers and thinking they reflect national numbers. Do they, or nationally, we continue to get more and more every year?
So nationally, the numbers have been flat until the last few years. There are typically around 2,500 transplants done in the United States each year for the last decade or so. And those numbers were actually down. In the last two or three years, heart transplant numbers are up as well. There are about 2,800 done in the United States last year.
And that's because, tragically, more hearts are available. Tell me where those hearts are coming from.
So those hearts are coming from several different strategies and several different sources. I think the thing that you refer to that is so tragic, it's obviously tragic when people die.
Sure.
We have seen an uptick in the tragic deaths of young people due to the opioid epidemic. These are young people. Their organs are, of course, in excellent shape, and it's tragic that we see these increase in numbers. But the organ donor pool, per se, has also been increased because we've been able to identify and transplant donors that were previously thought not to be suitable for donation. There are conditions like hepatitis, which we've become much better at testing donors for, and actually can treat recipients. So even for very desperately ill people, it is possible to take an organ that might have been infected with hepatitis C and treat those people with antiviral agents and prevent them, prevent a patient from ever getting hepatitis. And that was not possible before. We excluded many, many organs because of our fear of transmitting a disease.
Is the pool of needed recipients growing, or does that stay stagnant?
I think it's growing as well, although cardiovascular diseases, things like coronary artery disease, are actually declining a little bit. The number of patients with heart failure or failing hearts are actually increasing because patients are surviving their heart attacks. They're surviving these conditions, and then they develop heart failure and go on to need transplant. So about 5,000 patients each year are on the transplant list.
It is an exciting number. It's an interesting, I mean, the opioid angle, it just hadn't occurred to me, but it makes perfect sense. We're about out of time, but tell me about the development of the procedure. I don't think you would ever say it's become routine, but it seems as if it's become more, it's moving toward routine.
It's become more common, we just are at the 51st anniversary of the first heart transplant. Just about 2 weeks ago was the 51st anniversary. So the procedure's only been being performed in humans for 50 years, so we've come a long way.
Dr. Alan Anderson from Northwestern Memorial Hospital, the Bloom Cardiovascular Institute. Congratulations, and thanks for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks to you and your audience. Have a great holiday.
Absolutely. You as well. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. So this story about the Sears downturn seems to get more and more interesting by the week. The latest comes after Friday, when a decision from a judge approved Sears to pay out nearly $25 million in bonuses, despite the company losing roughly $2 billion in less than a year. They said the reasoning behind it is that they need to encourage important employees to stay with the company as they navigate the restructuring. If this was the sports world, this would commonly be looked at as a rebuild opportunity, clearing out the roster and starting fresh. But they're trying something different. And speaking of starting fresh, let's start fresh and move forward into the new year now that Amazon HQ2 madness is done. But first, let's look back on what Chicago promised the online giant. We have more details now that documents have been released from the city, showing that over $2.2 billion in tax breaks were promised to the online retailer, and we were in the running the entire way, as Deputy Mayor Bob Rivkin said. But like I said, we're looking forward. No looking back. I gotta learn how to grow and be strong. Oh, pull it together. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Elise Glink is on a phone line. You should check out her newsletters and such at thinklink.com. Also, the brains behind bestmoneymoves.com, an HR app for employees to help deal with their financial stress. Elise, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Nice to be here, Steve. Thank you.
So, we've got some financial stress on Wall Street. I want to get to that. But first, in your newsletter that I got today, you were writing about me. And it's about these impulse shopping. I'm not kidding you. I live this story. impulse shopping during the holidays. You know, you fall for these ads. You click on your phone. It's so easy. The stores make it so easy for you to buy something quickly. And then you come to regret it. Credit card purchases made from mobile devices are three times more likely to default than a credit card payment made from your laptop, where you're probably thinking about it more. Okay, so on Instagram, I saw this jacket that I thought, oh, this is a nice-looking jacket over, I think it was on Black Friday or something. I bought it quickly. I kind of started regretting it before it came in the mail. And it said on the app, it said, you know, the sizes tend to run small, so order large. So I ordered an extra large. I typically wear a large. I got it in the mail this week, last week, and I can't put it on. It's so small. I'm stuck with it. Well, I'm not stuck with it. Now my son's got a really cool jacket because it fits him perfectly. But it's an example of sort of buying without checking things out.
Yeah, I'm a big believer, Steve, that if you don't actually need something, and I mean need it today, deferring purchases and just trying to really make a decision about whether or not that's something that's going to be meaningful to your life is a good move, and it's a good thing to teach your kids when they're young. You just don't need to. The impulse buys tend to not work out as well as you would hope, and this is a great example of it, although, you know, Merry Christmas to your son,
right? I know, except he opened it, and I opened it in front of him, so it's I can't rep it. But you also suggest, and this has, I have found this absolutely to be the case, to find the same piece of merchandise on another website, and you can often find it cheaper rather than, you talked about the portals, you know, they just click a couple of clicks and you've made your purchase, and then you're sort of trapped, I mean, short of a return.
Yeah, it's really a concern, actually, for a lot of people, because they see something and they're told it's a great deal, this is a Black Friday deal, but they haven't checked around the pricing. So, again, I'm a big fan of taking your time, shopping around. What you'll find often, even in some of the fanciest of retail stores, the big first initial, hey, we're letting you in early kind of sale, typically 2 weeks later is replaced by another sale, which is even bigger, which is replaced by another sale at even, you know, deeper discount. And so the discounting that we're seeing, it continues all the way through until, you know, the first week of January, and then everything seems to reset. Whatever they've had in stock has been sold, and everything starts again. So don't feel like you're at your very last moment and you're never going to see that deal again. Trust me, it's going to come around.
And we need discounting because of, well, the markets are down. The more stocks moving into bear territory. The Dow is down more than 1.5% today. I was sitting with someone earlier today, and they said, well, you know, everyone's talking about a recession. Is that going to happen? And I don't know if it's going to become self-fulfilling, but people are bracing for it, and Wall Street seems to be reflecting that.
I think that we are going to face a recession, and if for no other reason other than we've had the greatest, longest expansion just about, except for maybe one or two others in history.
Well, that's what I told her. I said, look, we're certainly due. And, you know,
we are.
You're the expert, but just one other thing, if I can interject, you know, for a lot of young adults, this will be their first. because, you know, the last big recession was in 2008-2009. They've come of age economically without ever going through this sort of cycle.
That's correct. It's going to be very painful for them. I think it's going to be a particularly painful recession. And the thing that I say to people, Steve, is that, you know, you look around at the number of Americans who are living paycheck to paycheck. That number is roughly 78% right now. And this is falls strictly within my best money moves realm, right?
Sure.
So 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and over 70% of Canadians are living paycheck to paycheck, and over 70% of UK residents are living paycheck to paycheck. And this is supposed to be the best economy that we've had in 12 years. That, to me, portends a larger problem. And what you're starting to see in the news is that internationally, there's already weakening that's going on. And the U.S.'s market has stayed strong for the moment, but when all of our trading partners are not doing well, eventually we're going to catch that cold as well. And so that's when your recession will start here.
So what you just said, I think, in other words, is that even in very good economic times, they're not good enough for more than 70% of our population.
Yeah, it's not good enough for people to not live paycheck to paycheck. And my big concern, of course, is, you know, why is that happening? Why are people living paycheck to paycheck? And the answer, I think, is very clear. While wages have gone up a little bit over the last year or two, just a very little bit, over the last 20 years, we basically haven't seen incomes rise. And in fact, after you factor in inflation, wages were down. And so cost of living has gone up, and the amount of debt that we're carrying has gone up, and student loans has gone up. Everything else has really gone up, and yet wages for the vast majority of people have not gone up in any meaningful way. That's what I mean when I say people are living paycheck to paycheck.
And so when people complain about the disparity in income in this country, this is what it gets us.
It is, and I think you have to also look at the idea that, you know, millennials who, you know, keep talking about how they don't have as much money. There's a new study that came out from the Federal Reserve Bank that said millennials are spending less than previous generations because they literally have less money to spend. And I think it's instructive because we keep hearing about how millennials aren't saving, but the truth is they can't save. And so what, you know, Gen X and baby boomers and the great generation, they all had more money at the same ages than millennials do today. And I think that that's also a very scary trend.
Elise Glink, check out more at thinklink.com or also Best Money Moves. Elise, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Steve. See you soon.